Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by BlackRock Health, providing patients with world-class clinical care and comfort, enabling swifter recoveries.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Now, the teenage years can be a difficult, angst-ridden time for many as they navigate the path between the enchantment of childhood and the reality of the world in which we live. In her new book, What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You, psychotherapist Stella O'Malley takes parents inside the teenage brain and provides practical advice for the key milestones in the teenage years, helping them navigate issues such as anxiety, an obsession with technology and body confidence. And Stella O'Malley joins me now. Morning, Stella.
Hi there.
Listen, I have your book in front of me and it's entitled What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You. So much interesting stuff in it. Why is there often such angst and breakdown in communication between teenagers and their parents?
Well, when we think about it, it's actually quite understandable why, because really between the ages of 0 and 10, there's this kind of magical childhood, which has become incredibly magical in the last few decades, where they have been sold a story where the good guys always win. Life is fair. You know, everything is magical. There's fairies and there's everything. And they go to, you know, Legoland and Harry Potter or whatever. And then between 10 and 20, there's this awful reckoning of learning that life is, it's a bitter pill in fairness. It's a very bitter pill of learning life isn't fair, that sometimes the bullies are incredibly popular and very good looking, that sometimes awful things happen and none of us have figured out why. Mm-hmm. None of us actually figured out what is going on. Back in previous decades, I think an awful lot of adolescents would have turned to religion or they turned to politics to try and make sense of what have we landed in this earth? Because between 10 and 20, they figure out what they've landed in is actually a very strange scenario where we can't rely on fairness, we can't rely on almost anything. Yeah. And then at the very same time as all that is happening, which is a big reckoning, they have a kind of an unformed brain, even though they look very sophisticated and they can speak very well. I often think it's like an unmade cake insofar as you look in the oven and it looks beautiful. And then inside there's a mush of ingredients that are completely uncooked. And the teenager looks very well, speaks as well as an adult, but inside they have an unformed brain. It's half formed. So by the time they're in their early 20s, it'll form. But their emotional brain is much more developed than their logical and their reasoning brain. So literally they're playing with half a deck at the very same time as they're getting this massive influx of hormones and a realization of life is really hard. And I think when you put all that together, you think, wow, that is actually, of all the decades, that's the big decade where everything drops. And I think it is very hard.
And the sector of the teenage brain that tends to dominate during teenage years, how does its dominance reflect itself in their behaviour?
Massively. And I do think, that's why I go into it in the book, I do think when you read about their brain, you kind of think, ah, no. We'll have to be soft on them now, because you realise, for example, if their ability to weigh up risk, if you look at a teenage brain, they can just see, almost in neon technicolour, they can see the benefits. And their ability to assess the actual risk and see the consequences is underdeveloped in their brain. It's actually underdeveloped and it will develop, but it'll be in their 20s, which is why they might make reckless, impulsive decisions. And when you actually read about it, you do kind of think, you have a lot more compassion. You know, if you're really frustrated with your teenager, go and look up the teenage brain and you go, ah, now here, what I have, the deck of cards I have compared to what they have isn't the same. And so their ability to kind of act rationally and wisely and with kind of a logical sequence of events, it's not fully formed. Mm. And that's hard.
So when it comes to teenagers, you know, I know from chatting to parents, they often feel ignored. They worry they're not getting through to their teenagers. Is that a reality? I mean, do you think parents lose importance as children enter adolescence?
They do. And it's appropriate they do. Because, you know, they say about, adolescence is to break the spell of childhood. And I think, you know, the job of the adolescents is to kind of go through the kind of tasks of adolescence. So when the toddler has to learn to tie their lace or learn to ride a bike, the adolescent has to pull away from the parent ultimately and live their own life, handle complex relationships, handle kind of being on their own in life and doing their own thing. And so they kind of have to drown out, they have to turn down the parent like as if they're the radio, like turn them down while they turn in all the other influences, whether it's on social media or friends or whatever. They turn on all the other influences and then ultimately they become their own person. So it's appropriate they're turning the parent down, but it's actually very distressing.
For the parents?
Ah, it is. And there's this kind of wall in the bedroom that like parents can't penetrate. It's like an electric fence that a dog can't go through. And I kind of give strategies around that, trying to kind of, in a way, kind of penetrate that wall of silence.
What are those strategies? Everyone is screaming at the radio. What are those strategies, Stella?
Yeah. I think one thing that is quite helpful to do is if your child has that wall and they don't let you through into the bedroom, that you come in every so often with a nice drink and you just leave it there and just say, I just thought you'd like it. Or you might come in and say something nice, a sentence, and leave. So that you're coming in regularly, but you're not coming in and you ignore the mess. Yeah. And you don't try and give a Hollywood speech of motivation. You say something short and sweet, like, I got this for you. Yeah. And you walk back out so that it's becoming a little more commonplace that you're allowed into the room and you do it regularly. Kind of like throwing pebbles in a barrel. Over time, it'll fill up rather than thinking I'm going in there and I'm going to give it socks and, you know, and yeah, ignore the mess.
Because that's confrontation, isn't it?
And it becomes really conflict driven. Mm. As soon as she comes in, there's war. And so you've got to break that kind of dynamic by coming in short and sweet regularly. And leaving before you get thrown out.
And I suppose although they're friends, they're hugely influential at this age. You say in your book, parents are still the most important role model and the scaffold on which everything rests. Mm,
yeah, I think it's really important. I think a lot of us parents, and I'm a parent myself, we think they have to individuate. They have to go off. So I just hope they're all right. These days, and all days, we always did need our parents. They were kind of the project managers of the household, of the tone of the household, of, you know, the attitude at breakfast, the kind of the vibe at dinner. You know what I mean? We adults are the people who are setting the tone. And you do have to lean in on some level with the acknowledgement that they have to have freedom to go out. And I know I'm being a classic psychotherapist here. So on the one hand and on the other hand, you do have to do both. But I do think it's a lot of us, especially because of social media, we throw our hands up in the air and we think there's nothing we can do. It's a beast. The teenagers are off on their own. I've no idea what they're doing up in their bedroom. Good luck and goodbye. And I'm like, yeah, but some of them are really distressed and need a kind of kindly word. They do need you to have your eye on it. On the general vibe of what's going on, rather than just hoping for the best and keeping your fingers crossed.
In the book, you actually, Stella, break teenagers into three groups. Tell me about these three groups.
It's from the psychologist Carl Pickard, and he made a very good point where he said about a third of teenagers, they sail through. It's all right. It's pretty fine. Then about a third, and they have a few stumbles, a few tricky moments, but ultimately, and then a third who are really have a very difficult time. And I noticed when I read that, I saw that in my clinical practice. This is actually true. Some of them just have a few stumbles. They come in, we kind of put them back in the rails and they're all right and off they go. But there's a third that just seemed, roughly, like we don't have this indefinite, that just seem to have a really hard time. But now, if you look at babies, some babies randomly just are really, really difficult. And then they're all right in childhood. And the same with children. There's some children who are just really difficult. And so we each have our phases, and it's not necessarily, you can't pick out the teenager and say, who's going to be the successful adult? Do you follow me?
Yeah,
it's kind of noticeable that sometimes you would never have seen it in their teenage years, what they're going to be like as adults.
So a tricky adolescent isn't necessarily a tricky adult?
No. No,
okay, interesting.
It's not.
Is there a difference between boys and girls?
Oh, my, yeah, there is massive.
Okay, who's more difficult?
Both.
Good.
Yeah, it's very hard. Like, it's very, you can make sweeping generalizations, and we do, but yeah, there is differences in working with boys and working with girls. And often, I think, especially, with a sweeping generalization, we sometimes presume that talking is always the way forward, and some people are much more physical, where a hug or their favourite dinner or a blanket and put on the fire and put on their film will go a lot further than, and I'm saying this as a psychotherapist, than talking about it. We kind of have overdone the let's talk about it. And some people, they're more physical. They'd be better off having a hot shower or going for a run. Or it's not always talking that is cathartic. And that's something that we have kind of over, I think we've over-egged that a little bit. And for some people, they don't feel the release and the catharsis that I feel. Mm. I know I feel it. Some people feel it more in the physicality of, I went for a run and I feel much, much better and I feel able for life. And I think we have to give room for the different ways people respond to hardship and not presume always that talking is the only way. Mm. There's lots of ways, and we have to tune into the kid in front of us and how they feel better. And like I say, it might be something much more physical.
Yeah, a hug and a hot chocolate.
Yeah, definitely.
So talk to me a little about, I suppose, how teenagers perceive the world, because offline, they live in a world of rules and boundaries, but online, really, anything goes. I mean, how do they deal with these contradictory realities?
I think it's a very big issue, in fairness. Like, we're about 10 years into this kind of social experiment where there's more high-speed Wi-Fi in our pockets and the social media platforms have really taken off, and it feels like it's the Wild West, and an awful lot of kids are incredibly shaped by their online life. And so they often have this incredibly strict physical life, and then the online life can be wild. And so that's a very kind of, it's an extremist on both sides. And they have noted that the more, and the studies have shown that the more constricted somebody is physically, the wilder they'll be online in adolescence. And I can see why, because adolescents need to push the boundaries. They need to take a few risks. So if they're taking no risks, never go to a disco, never meeting their friends, they're more likely to seek risks online. So I am kind of really quite into kind of allowing them out, allowing them to go to the disco, allowing them to go out, if at all possible, meet their friends, maybe go shopping, maybe get a bus and go in on their own. That they have to learn to live some sort of kind of risk-taking life outside the bedroom, or else they're going to look for all their thrills online. And that's not very healthy.
Yeah, interesting. Now, you don't raise this issue in your book, but it has to be said, you've previously, Stella, been criticised for your views on transgender issues and gender dysphoria. How do you respond to criticisms levelled at you in that regard?
I think fair criticism is always something that people have to take note of, and I certainly would listen to it very intently. And I don't profess to have any or all of the answers, but I do think I've tried to be measured and I try to ask decent questions in an honourable way. And I think life is very heightened these days, so I just try to keep my own kind of integrity, that if I have a question that I ask it and I kind of stand by that without feeling that I hope I don't offend people. I certainly try not to.
Why didn't you deal with transgender issues, I suppose, in this book? It is, after all, it's a concern for some young people.
Well, I'm writing a book with two other psychotherapists, Lisa Marciano and Sasha Ayad, and we're focusing on managing gender in the family. So that seemed to be the more appropriate place to put it.
You occasionally in the book, you use the word coddled, Stella, when you refer to teenagers today. Well, what do you mean? In what ways are they coddled when compared, I suppose, with previous generations?
I think I was quite influenced by The Coddling of the American Mind, that book. And I think, you know, often what happens in America happens in Ireland 10 years later. And that book was quite shocking about how keeping the kids online or inside and kind of, I hesitate to say coddled, but certainly they're living a very safe life. And it's not going very well for them mentally. That the safety isn't the be-all and end-all. We presume it is, because safety almost is a synonymous with good. And I'm like, yeah, it's not actually. In adolescence, the idea is you're starting to stretch your boundaries, you're starting to move out, you're starting to kind of, you have your first crush. You're going into uncharted territory, and it's very scary for the parents, it's very scary for the teenager, but it's appropriate. And keeping us in a padded room full of safety isn't mentally healthy. And all the anxiety, and I see so much anxiety in my clinical practice, so much fear of getting older, fear of going out, fear of having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, that it's like, it's okay, we're in a very safe society where actually there is an awful lot of health and there's an awful lot of education. We should be okay if we take kind of measured risks. We should be okay. Yet tragedies happen and they will always happen and we have to be aware of that. But ultimately for our mental health, adolescents need to take some risks, and that's something that parents, annoyingly, we have to stomach.
And now, look, we've talked a lot about the storms, the stresses of adolescence, but like, there are a lot of positives. Like, yeah. I've got a 17-year-old at home and he's dote. I mean, like, there's a lot of positive characteristics,
yeah.
aren't there?
Yeah, there's a concept called professional deformation, as in you get deformed by your own profession. And I sometimes think I have it. I shouldn't laugh. But I'm full of the doom because I see it. I see it among my clients. I see more teenagers than I see of any other group. And the teenagers that come to me tend to be really distressed and in kind of really in their mental hell. And that's when I see them. In fairness, I have two teenagers myself who say to me exactly what you've said, which is, you're overdoing it, man. Like, really, it's not that bad, which is a bit embarrassing.
You also write that over the years, you know, working with teenagers, you find a pretty reliable approach to building a connection with one. Describe how do you build that connection?
Yeah, I think if I have anything to kind of give as a therapist, the kind of the two big traits I have that I think kind of go well, and I do get on with teenagers. I was a very troubled teenager myself, so I think I kind of zero in on where they are quite easily. But if you can have empathy and kind of get in the trenches with them, and I think a lot of adults tend to say, you know, oh, you'll be all right, smile, cheer up, and don't quite go, oh, this is hard. And quite go into that trench. So that's one thing I do. And the other thing I think is being authentic, giving my authentic response as opposed to the slightly glib, you know, it'll get better. It's very, very easy to be glib and cheery and positive. It's much harder to say this is really hard.
Finally, I know it's a question everyone asks on every radio show all the time, but I suppose in terms of boundaries about technology, this morning there's lots of people and their teenagers are going to get up and they're going to be glued to their phones. Do you have to impose boundaries? And how do you do that even with, say, a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old? I mean, that's tricky, isn't it?
As they get to 17 and 18, your impact is really reduced. I do think you have to look at it like you'd look at junk food, or you wouldn't let an 18-year-old drink vodka at breakfast time. So you look at it like a healthy consumption, if you follow me. And so, for example, I kind of offer strategies along the lines of no tech in the kitchen. So you remember that everybody had to go outside to smoke, and it kind of put manners on all of us, and people smoked a lot less. The same as if you have to leave the kitchen to go on your phone, you'll do it more purposefully. And for younger teens, I do think you have to be all over monitoring their content on their passwords. Like when they're 13 and 14, that's when the mad stuff happens, as opposed to when they're 15 and 16, they've often learned sense. It's kind of the 12, 13 is where really messes happen. And they've kind of gone way out of their depth into kind of adult territory that they do not know what to do with. And in fairness, I think adults should be all over that sort of content.
Well, look, Stella O'Malley, thanks so much for coming in today. And your book, it's a great read, What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You, is available now and it's published by Gale Books. Thanks very much for being my guest this morning.
Thank you.